As the normal chairperson is not here today, and I am in his stead, I've been told that Russell will be introducing our speaker, who and I will leave it to him to introduce her. Look forward to hearing her today.
Yeah, g'day. Russell Addict, I have the disease of addiction.
Hi,
Hi,
Russell.
Russell. Thank you, Leslie, for coming to speak and share at our meeting. I first came across Leslie some months ago in a meeting in Australia. Out of foster, and I like what I heard, so I approached her to see if she was up for coming and sharing with us, and eventually we got the connection made, and the things that really attracted me to what I heard, and that I'm looking forward to hearing tonight, was her story of how she lives today, how she lives the steps in her life. And the only things I've heard her share was the process of steps in daily life in situations that she had or has. Now, I find that very attractive. I also heard a lot of stuff around compassion for fellow addicts in all states of recovery or disrepair, whichever you like, and that how that takes place with her in daily life, not just in meetings. So, welcome, Leslie. I'm looking forward to hearing you share. So the floor is yours, and speak for as long as you like. And once it gets to 3 hours, we might give you a yell. But generally around about 3 quarters of an hour or more, and there's no hassle if it's more. So over to you.
Oh, I'm Leslie. I'm an addict.
Hi, Leslie. Welcome to
Hey, Leslie. Thanks,
the
Russell.
meeting. Glad you're
Hi,
here.
everybody. Wow, Russell, what a fantastic introduction. You've obviously been having your listening ears on. So I just hope that I can live up to that amazing introduction. Yeah, I don't think I've done a share for this length of time for quite a significant amount of time. So I know it's experience, strength, and hope. So I'm going to try and do about 15 minutes on each bit of that. I thought if I try and simplify it, it might work, but who knows, you know. So I guess I'll tell you a bit about what brought me to NA. My life was, I was born into this disease. I was born into a family of addicts, both parents, one very functional and ex-military, and then one not functional at all. So for the whole of the time that I lived at home, you know, from a young child into my teenage years, I was surrounded by this disease. And I can remember very vividly, as probably around 10 or 11, wanting to escape and finding ways to escape from the life, you know, from my family life. And a lot of that time would be spent reading, you know, escaping to books. And then as I got a little bit older and probably a little bit more riskier, I found other ways to make me feel different, I guess. The first thing I found was shoplifting. And it was kind of the edginess of it. And whenever I got away with it, you know, that euphoria that I felt. And I can remember I used to do a lot of babysitting, and one particular lady that I babysat for, I was probably around 12 at this age. I remember being in her bathroom because I was a bit snoopy when I used to babysit, used to look through all the cupboards and drawers. So I was in her bathroom, going through her bathroom cabinet, and I found this bottle of pills. I had no idea what they were, and I took one. And within, I don't know, probably about 20 minutes or so, I felt different. I felt quite lightheaded, a bit woozy, and I liked the feeling. And every time I went back to babysit for that lady, I would take these tablets. I know now they were Valium. I didn't know at the time. The little yellow ones. So, that was kind of my first introduction, I guess, to medication and how that could change how I felt. And my home life, you know, both of my parents drank a lot every night. And I'm from a really big family. And they used to drink a lot at home and down the pub, but mainly at home. And we would be pouring their drinks for them. And I can remember when they used to just pass out or whatever, I'd always drain the glass. And then I kind of got a bit braver when I was pouring their drinks. I'd have a little swig of it as well. And never enough to get me drunk, but I don't know. I can't ever remember feeling anything from that, but I can definitely remember doing it. So I can look back now, from probably about the age of 10, where I was kind of experimenting with, you know, narcotics of different types. And my childhood was a really unhappy one. You know, we were very poor. And I know now why we were so poor, because both parents being addicts, that was their priority. And they had six children, all of us at one point under the age of 10. And we was brought up in a lot of poverty, a house full of anger, angst, discipline, physical punishments. And I really hated my home life. I hated it. And I could not wait to get away. And for me, my escape was at 17, I got pregnant and I moved out. And I think about that now and I think, oh my God, I was a child having a child. You know, I was so young. I didn't, when I moved out, I didn't have any life skills at all, because my parents didn't role model those to us, you know. And I had no real emotional resilience. I think I was a teenager that was very hypervigilant because of the environment that I grew up in. So I was always expecting something to happen. And yeah, that was kind of how I lived. And I moved out, I had my son, and I was 18 at that point. And, you know, kind of at weekends, I'd go out with friends. And hindsight is a great thing, isn't it? Because you can look back and see there is lots of warning signs there that I wouldn't have known, because, you know, I didn't think anything about addiction at that point. I didn't even really know that my mum and dad were addicts. So I used to go out every weekend and I never drank like my friends. I always drank until, until the point of what I now know to be a blackout. And I'd wake up the next morning and my friends would be telling me what I did. And oh, I would just cringe, some of the things that I got up to. And I just kind of thought it was normal. I just thought that they just didn't drink as much as me. That was kind of it. I didn't overanalyze it. And, being a teenager, I just thought I was having a great old time. So kind of fast forward a few years, I got pregnant again. I was 22, had my second son. And when he was 11 weeks old, he died. He died of a cot death. And at that point, back then, it was a lot of years ago. I'm going to be 59 this year. So you can imagine how long ago it was. It wasn't the resources available that we have today. And I can remember my mum taking me to the doctors and they gave me medication, which I loved because it literally just shut my head up. I don't know to this day what it was, but I can remember they gave me enough for about 2 weeks and I was back there after 5 days. I'd taken it all because every time the feeling from whatever that medication was started to wear off, I took another one because I couldn't deal with the reality of my son dying. And the day of the funeral, my mum was so drunk that she nearly fell in the grave. It was a fucking horrendous time. And about 3 weeks after my son had died, I remember my dad saying to me, "Well, you need to get yourself together now. You need to get on with life." And that was my childhood. Like, you weren't allowed to show any emotion. If you did cry because you'd had a good hiding, you were told to get to your room and stay there till you'd stop crying. So from a really young age, I learned how to shut my emotions down, to just suppress them. And then as I got older, I used things to keep them suppressed unknowingly. I didn't know any of this at the time. So about a year after my son died, I met a guy. I was really vulnerable. I'd had no support, no counseling. I remember a few weeks after my son died, I'd moved into my parents for a few weeks with my other son, just because I didn't want to be in that house. And then the day came that I went back, and I went in there, and my son who'd passed away, Joseph, everything that belonged to him had gone. It'd all been taken. And I can remember like going back to my mom's and saying, "Everything of Joseph's is gone. I can't find anything." And she was like, "Yeah, we went and cleared it all out. We thought that was best." So I'd gone back to my home and it was like he'd been completely erased. About a year after this happening, I'd had no support. My family were like, "You need to move on." Everything got shut down. Wasn't allowed to kind of talk about anything. Didn't have anyone to talk about it to, if I'm honest, because it's one of those topics, isn't it? Losing a baby or any child that people feel really uncomfortable talking about. Anyway, I was working in a pub, in a local pub, because I liked working in pubs because I could drink and I could get free drink, and I'd always get pissed as well. But I met this guy in there, and unknowing to me, he was a heroin addict. And the story goes probably the same as everyone else's, quite quickly into that relationship, I'd started experimenting with heroin and found myself with a habit. And I was in that relationship for about 11 years. And it was just awful. I got introduced to a way of life that I could never I've imagined having quite quickly anybody that I'd grown up with, all my friends and family, I no longer had any contact with. And I was just, I'd kind of embedded myself into this world of people that used the same drugs that I used. I got to know or got told all the kind of tricks to do with the doctor, to get on a methadone script, to kind of ask for this tablet, ask for that tablet. So within maybe another year of meeting that guy, I was addicted to a cocktail of different substances, and I'd begun sex working to support not only my habit but to support his. And there was absolutely nothing about my addiction at any point that was glamorous. Never. I hear some people go, oh, when it first started off, it was fun and it was like this. Mine wasn't, because I kind of gone from someone I knew that I at weekends when I'd gone out and I drank differently to someone, within a year of working on the streets, having a habit to lots of different substances and in a relationship that was extremely violent and abusive. And to be honest, that I would like to tell you, this, that, and the other, but that was my life for the next 11 years. It was like Groundhog Day. The only things that changed were the fact, well, the people that I used with, because they would either die, move, probably some of them got clean, but I never at that point of my using heard of anyone getting clean. So it's the people that I used with, the amount of drugs that I took, because obviously this is a progressive illness. So as time ticked by, I needed more and more of different things to get the same result. And I remember, I think I'd been about 5 years into my addiction to heroin and other medications when I entered into a drug service. And yeah, they straight away were like, we'll put you in detox and we'll send you off to a rehab. And at that point in time, when if they sent you to rehab, you went there for like 18 months. Which now I think, God, you can't even get funding for bloody 1 month, but that's how it was. And I did that every year for 12 years. I went into detox every year for 12 years. And I think in that time, I went to four different rehabs. And I think, a couple of them were 12-step rehabs. And I think whenever I went into one of them, into a treatment facility, it planted a little seed of something. And one of them in particular, it was a farm. And I can remember, like, I was withdrawing, I got, when I arrived there, I was withdrawing from lots of different things. And it was only like my second day, and they sent me up. It was a really hot summer's day when I got there. And the second day, they sent me off into this field to pull carrots. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? The ground was so hard and tough. I was so weak. I couldn't get these carrots out of the ground. And I just remember sitting there crying, thinking, oh my God, what's happened to me? But in my time there was this guy that used to come in. This was in Nottingham. And he used to come along with a minibus, and he'd load us all into this minibus. We were like a load of lunatics. And he'd take us into Nottingham to an NA meeting. And I can remember going to these meetings, and I didn't believe anything. Years later, I remember saying to someone, I didn't hear any readings. You know how we start the meeting off with readings, and they must have done them, but I couldn't remember hearing any. And the whole point, the whole reason for me to go to those meetings was because I was quite young at the time, I was still in my 20s, was to see guys. It was a bit like a social event. And I'd hear people sharing, and they, they looked like really clean, really happy. really like they got their lives together. And I just used, I thought, no, I don't believe it. You know, just couldn't believe it. But that was part of my process. And during this time, my mom had got into recovery in another fellowship. And, you know, on the occasions where I wasn't in rehab and I was, or I wasn't in detox, because services liked to send me away. I was a really chaotic person when I was using in many different ways, always in violent relationships, always sex working, just the nightmare that is, that was me. So they'd always like get funding and send me somewhere. And when I wasn't in one of those facilities and I was out and I was using, my mum used to take me along to AA meetings with her. And I can remember going to those meetings, and all I was ever shown, I remember this really vividly, was real honest love and compassion from the people in those meetings. And, you know, I'd be sitting there and I'd be gouching out and I'd be dribbling and dropping my tea and just being a general pain in the arse. And whenever the meeting ended and I was leaving with my mom, they'd be like, see you next week, Leslie. You know, no one ever mentioned like the chaoticness of myself. I wasn't disruptive or anything. I was just like a mess. I was ill, I was unwell. So these two situations were what introduced me to 12-step recovery. And I could go on and on about my using, but it's not about the war stories for me today, because I think in saying what I've said, you can kind of form your own picture of what it was like. You know, that it was dark, it was depressing, and at the end, it was soul destroying, because there was nothing alive in me. It had all been taken, you know. My disease had robbed me of everything. And in 2007, I did my last stint in a detox, and I'd also, at the end of my addiction, I'd got pregnant again and had a daughter. And I was so chaotic and so unmanageable. You know, my addiction was my priority and my daughter came second. My son by this point was living with his dad, and children's services stepped in and took my daughter away from me and placed her in the care of my sister. So that happened, and quite quickly, you know, services were like, right, we're going to put you back in detox. We want you to go to a treatment center. And I agreed. That was in 2007. And what I did was I don't know, it's probably one of those higher power moments where I made some different choices about the treatment center that I went to. The first choice that I made was that it would be an all-female one, so that there wouldn't be any handy distractions for me. And the second one was that it was a 12-step treatment center. And I went into this beautiful, honestly, the most beautiful place here in Norwich, in Norfolk. And it was very small. It was a Christian treatment center. I didn't have any problem with that. But they used to sing songs in the morning, and I didn't really like that because I hadn't kind of thawed out enough to appreciate the singing and the nice words. But I went in there, and it took me about, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks before I even landed. You know, I was there physically, but mentally I just hadn't arrived. And the reason I picked that treatment centre as well was because I lived in the Midlands in Derbyshire, and my daughter was living with my sister in Norfolk. So for me, it was like, okay, I want to be as near to my daughter as possible. So yeah, I went in there, and I didn't even know that I was in recovery in the beginning. It was like, you know, I was doing all of these, we can imagine what it's like in rehab, you're doing all of these groups, and it was all focused around the 12 steps, and I didn't have a bloody clue what was going on. And I used to hear like like my peers in there talking about the disease. And I can remember saying to someone, what's wrong with these people that saying they've got a disease? Because even though I'd been to meetings, I didn't take anything in. And then at this point in rehab, they're talking about the disease. And I just was like, what? I knew I was an addict. I knew that. I had lots of evidence to support that. But then when I started hearing people talk about the disease, my brain couldn't compute. And part of the process of being in there was that we did step work. We worked mainly up to the first five steps, but we also had H&I meetings come in there. And I can remember one of those H&I meetings, a woman shared, and she shared my story, all of the things that I'd been doing in my active addiction that I felt really ashamed of and dirty about, and thought no one's as bad as me. She shared about them, and it blew me away because I'd never ever heard anyone with such honesty in my life. And that woman became my first sponsor. So I used to love H&I meetings, and because I was a right pain in the arse in the treatment centre, you can imagine. When I arrived there, I was like a feral animal. I didn't, anyone said no to me, I wasn't having it, and I was kind of full of self-will and rebelliousness. They knocked that out of me, I can assure you. But so for like the first 3 months of being there, I wasn't allowed to go anywhere on my own because it was such a bloody risk. But then after 3 months, they were like, right, you need to go out to meetings now. And I started going out to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And you know what? The first time I walked into a meeting in my area, I remember walking in and there was this atmosphere of love, happiness, and it just generated out of the people in there. There was people in that meeting with significant clean time, and it was so attractive to me anyway. It was so attractive, and I can remember just being in awe, and but also like I just really lacked confidence. I wasn't really used to speaking to too many people because the only time I really spoke was to order drugs, to tell them what I wanted and then to go and get them. And I used on my own a lot. So it was, I hadn't found my voice, and I had no self-worth, no confidence. And I can remember if they used to give out the reading cards and I had to read a card, I would go bright red, I'd sweat. It was just such a traumatic experience. And I don't think I opened my mouth and shared for about 5 months in the meetings because I wanted to, I'd listen to people sharing and I'd get so much identification, but I just, when it came to like opening my mouth, it was just, it would not come out. And I think I got to 6 months and somebody asked me to do a share, like a main share, and I was filled with fear, but I agreed to do it because I thought, well, I'm going to have to do it at some point. And I can remember I obsessed about it for weeks. You know what it's like when you're new? It's like it was torture. And then the day I turned up to do this share, it was normally you shared for about 20, 25 minutes. And like I had been sharing for about 10 minutes and my head went blank. And I had nothing left. It had gone. Everything in my head had disappeared. I wish that would happen today, but it happened at that time. And I can remember just saying, "That's me, I'm done." And the look of bewilderment on people's faces. And it was a long time before I did another share again because I did it and then I just felt so raw, but I felt a bit stupid. And I know today, nobody cares. If somebody does a main share and all they can get out is 5 minutes, great, you shared for 5 minutes. That's how I feel anyway, And yeah, I just fully embedded myself in Narcotics Anonymous. I left that treatment centre after 7 and a half months. I'd already got into a relationship. I'd met the person that became my husband when I was 6 months clean in an NA meeting, and he picked me up from rehab and I moved in with him. So there wasn't a lot of change there. The type of guy I went for changed a bit, but not the actual kind of, meeting someone down a nightclub and that night giving them a front door key. That kind of didn't change. But what did change was that I left that rehab. I had a sponsor in place. I got service in every meeting because we had meetings here. We had tons of meetings in our area, but they had meetings every night. And I got a service position in every meeting because I didn't have anything else going on in my life. I didn't have a job. I didn't have my kids with me. I felt like I'd never get a job, that I was unemployable. But one thing I knew that I could do was go to meetings. And, I took direction from my sponsor. And for the next 8 years, I just focused on my recovery, building a life. I went back into education. I got lots of qualifications in different things. And just built a career for myself. I got an opportunity where I was, I went for a job. I wasn't qualified for it. I didn't get it, but the manager was kind of intrigued by my CV and the massive gaps in it. And then he called me back and I went to see him and he asked me about it. And I was just honest about my life. And he said, "Wow, you've got the lived experience." And he gave me this opportunity of a little job. Working with, disadvantaged people. And I loved that job. I was so proud of it. And I used to work every Saturday and Sunday for 10 hours, and it was amazing. And I can remember getting my first wage packet and in recovery, and I bought a lawnmower. Yeah, it was just like those little things that I can sometimes forget about until I do a share. And my partner and I, we got married, got 8 years. It was both 8 years clean. We had the same amount of clean time and we got married. And then things changed. I relapsed, I picked up again. I made a decision to use. I'm not going to justify it in any way. And I can go into everything that was happening at the time. But I've been through all of those things that were happening at the time. In at other times, and on this occasion, I used. And the reason I used was because I'd reduced the amount of meetings that I was doing significantly. I was getting resentments left, right, and centre. And I would turn up at meetings late, so I didn't have to hug anyone and say hello. And I would leave meetings early so that I didn't have to hug anyone and say goodbye. And then it got to the point where I'd get to the meeting and I'd look through the little window in the door. And if I didn't like someone in the meeting, I wouldn't go in. So I was then going like weeks without meetings. And when I was in the position where I was offered mood altering medication by my GP, I had no protection. The disease had done a real number on me and had separated me completely from recovery. And I had no armor. And that relapse took me out for 7.5 months. And it ended the night that I booked into a hotel with another female. We scored all the drugs that I hadn't used for 8 years. And I just had a night of binging on all of these drugs. I think today, I think, how the hell did I survive that? How did I survive that relapse? Because I had that night, the next day I used sleeping medication, and on the third day I went to a NA meeting and I picked up a white key ring. And I was in bits getting that key ring because it hadn't really registered with me that I'd been using. I knew I'd been using, but the severity of that hadn't registered. It was the devastation of losing my clean time I was crying about. And it took a couple of months for everything to kind of, for me to start feeling the impact of that relapse to kind of thaw out again and the fog start to lift. And you know, the day that I got that white key ring, I knew how cunning and baffling and powerful this disease is. I knew it, I felt it, and I felt that it was in me, you know, that it would do anything to take me out and destroy me, but not to just destroy me, to slowly destroy me and everything around me. So I made a decision then, you know, I'd been on other medication for nerve pain and I came off everything. I was like, I am not fucking about with this stuff anymore. You know, my life depends on this. And this is how it is for me. I can only speak for me and this is my experience. So I made a lot of changes. I went back to basics, obviously. I'm a newcomer, and back to 1990, back to doing my step one. I changed my job. It was just, it was a surreal experience because I had the life of someone with 8 years, nearly 9 years in recovery, but I had the emotional capacity of someone with a day clean, and they just didn't correlate with each other. And it was a very weird time. And I can remember that first year being back after that relapse, clinging onto my chair in meetings because my disease wanted me out. You know, I never wanted to use as much as I did in that first year. The obsession was so powerful. And I knew what was going to happen if I left meetings. I knew, you know, I now had evidence of a relapse to support that. So, you know, I'm back again, just over 8 years. And it's been a day at a time. And my recovery this time around has been very different. You know, I think initially I was extremely enthusiastic. I was a know-it-all, but what I did know, you could probably write on the back of a matchbox. And I was just one of those really annoying people that like thought they knew everything. I was complacent and arrogant, you know, and I learned from that because this time, oh, and I wanted to get through the steps, you know, because that was going to fix me getting through the steps as quickly as possible. And like I said, this time my recovery has been very, very different. I have the most amazing sponsor I could wish for. It lives in Florida and we have a beautiful relationship. And that woman shows me so much love. She's just unbelievable. And I'm not in any rush with anything. You know, I work in the field of addiction, and it's really, for me, that is where it is for me. I've struggled. I'll come to this in a bit. I've struggled a bit recently around this stuff. But when I see people coming into that service so destroyed by this disease, you know, people that are living on the streets that just are walked past, they're not even considered to be human beings, you know. For me, seeing people come into that service in that way, it's really important for me to reach out and to speak to them, and not to tell them about the 12-step program, because for me it is about attraction rather than promotion. If someone's interested, if I ever disclose my anonymity, I'll tell them what's working for me. But to just show compassion and love and kindness and hug people, especially the smelliest people. It's really important to hug the smelliest people because they're probably the ones that have had no human contact for a significant amount of time. And I don't give a shit. you know, the smellier the better. I gave him a bigger hug and a tighter hug, and I love it. And I'm, you know, I don't have as much contact, you know, I kind of in the management side of things now, because I really want to have an impact and make a difference to the services that we provide to our own, you know, because I've been part of those services for many years. And, you know, giving someone a bloody drug diary, Jesus Christ, what's that going to do? You know, giving someone a hug and a cup of tea and your time and hearing them, that's going to do more for that person in maybe the 5, 10 minutes you spend with them than a piece of paper asking them to write down what they've used that week. Fucking hell, my eyes were never open long enough to see a piece of paper or a pen. So I get it. And yeah, and it through the steps, you know, that process of working through the 12 steps has been a life-changing experience for me, you know, to understand my disease so totally. And believe me, it still baffles me. It still presents in different ways. It still tries to do a number on me. But to understand my disease and how it operates within me, you know, because when I came into this program, I was in need of a personality change. Believe me, I grunted at you, you know, I barked at you and I shouted at you because anger was normal for me. It's what I grew up with. It was just a normal emotion. And, you know, I'm speaking now from a place of years of being around this program, being in therapy, and consistently working through the steps, that I've been able to gain an understanding of myself on the deepest level that I never thought possible, you know. And I know my first time of working through the steps, it did what it needed to do. It cleared the rubbish out, you know. It was, I can look now and think that was quite superficial, but it wasn't. I can tell myself it was, but it wasn't. It did what it needed to do at the time. And each time I've gone through these steps, I've dug deeper and deeper into myself because I know that's where the stuff is at. And I've been able to change from this angry woman who was so confrontational, you know, pick up resentments left, right and centre with every Tom, Dick and Harry, telling everyone how they should do their recovery, but not having a fucking clue how to do my own, to somebody who, for me, I find it extremely important to live my life in line with the spiritual principles of this program. And the main ones being, you know, that love, kindness and compassion to others, because I truly believe that what I put out into the universe is what I'm going to get back. And I've had enough years of getting darkness, and I want to be in the light. You know, it's really important to me that, and don't get me wrong, I'm not perfect. I've had a bit of a week this week where I was doing the May challenge where I can't remember the exact way, but one of it was like, I may just fuck it, or yeah, something like that. And I've been a bit tetchy this week, and I've encountered situations that have made me slightly confrontational. And then I said to a friend, I'm not doing this challenge anymore because I'm putting out into the universe negativity, and I'm getting it back all the time. I can't cope with it. And it just feels more natural and easier for me to be like a kind, gentle, considerate person, you know. And this year, my marriage ended. Sorry, I know I'm hopping around a little bit here, but it will make sense. So I'd been with my husband for 17 years, and we'd grown apart, you know, both in recovery, and a lot happened over those years. You know, we had 15 amazing years together, and the last two not so amazing. And I made the decision that I wanted to be single. I wanted to live as a single woman and focus on myself. And so we decided to end the marriage. This was in December, and he moved out in January. And through that whole process, so we lived together, I think, for about 7 or 8 weeks after we'd decided that we were going to separate. And he said he would move out. And through that whole process, it was so important to me to conduct myself in a way that I would be proud of, you know, to do things differently, to be able to show him, because it was, even though it was a mutual decision, it kind of was instigated by myself. It was really important to show him, you know, love and tolerance and patience and kindness throughout that whole process, because he was the one that was moving out of his home. He was the one that kind of reluctantly, I guess, was leaving the marriage. And yeah, I didn't want the animosity to be there between us while we were still sharing the same space. And I'm not going to lie, it wasn't easy, but I was able to do it. And then 2 weeks after he moved out, he got into another relationship. And I was completely floored, because he'd been my best friend for 17 years. And I thought that best friend was going to continue to be there. And how he told me, I wasn't upset that he'd got into another relationship, because I kind of knew that was going to happen, not as quick as 2 weeks, but I knew it would happen. But it was how he told me. He phoned me while he was out on a date with his new girlfriend and said, yeah, I'm out on a date, we're going to the pictures. And he told me her name. And I was just like, what the fuck? After 17 years of sharing our lives, you're going to tell me in a phone call that you're with someone else. And it just sent me, it spiraled me into grief, you know, the loss of the marriage, the best friend, and the hurt and the pain. And I think Russell's probably heard the tail end of this quite a lot in meetings. And I, you know, at times those feelings consumed me. They really did. And there was part of me wanted to go around to where he lived and knock on his door and punch him square on the jaw and tell him about himself. But it wouldn't have achieved anything. You know, the harder thing to do was maintain my dignity in that situation and still send out that love and kindness to him. And I did it through gritted teeth at times, because he was angry, you know, when he would come round for whatever, when we had to communicate, he was always angry. And I was always emotional and crying, and it was a really difficult time. And I'm still not completely over it, you know, I'm still healing from that. But what's helped me in that healing journey is because what I did do for 6 months, I stopped going to face-to-face meetings, because he was going to meetings and I felt like it was important that he was able to do that, because I can do meetings online, and I really love online meetings. They don't faze me at all. You know, some people struggle with them, I don't. And I'd found a really good home group, so I was getting what I needed. And then when all of this happened, I knew that I needed to go back to face-to-face meetings as well. I needed that physical connection. And that's what I started to do. And there's been so many amazing things that's happened during that time. You know, it was important for me to have my own identity and not always be seen as part of this couple that had been together for all of that time. And, you know, I've now got a couple of friends that are, they're new around. They've been around, they've had relapses, and they're new around. And they've shown me so much love and acceptance, and they've allowed me to just be crazy Leslie at times when I'm just losing my shit and having a meltdown. And they've also made me laugh hysterically, you know, and made me feel very protected and safe. And they've been very vulnerable with me, and that's allowed me to be really vulnerable with them. And it's been the most beautiful experience to find such friendship, because one of the things that also happened in the marriage breakdown was, unfortunately, people do kind of take sides, and the guy seemed to take my husband's side, and the females got a bit tetchy because I was then on my own. And it's like, oh, they don't like single ladies. But, you know, I'm rebuilding things. And, you know, my main source of support is in online meetings, to be honest. But, you know, I have been doing 2 meetings a day for the last, I think it's 59 days, because what happened sort of a month or so into him getting into this new relationship was I became very unwell. You know, my disease manifested in food, where I was under eating, and then I wasn't sleeping, and then I was getting high from the not eating and sleeping and acting out obsessively around a guy. So I became really unwell, and I had a breakthrough and a breakdown at the same time when I picked up Recovery and Relapse and read it, and I thought, this is where I'm at. This is exactly where I'm at in this emotional and spiritual crisis. And if I don't do something now, I'm going to use, because I was backing myself into that corner. And I phoned my sponsor, and she was like, right, 90 days, discipline. And we made a list of things that I would do every day for the next 90 days. And one of those things was go back to step one and look at my how my addiction was manifesting at that point in time, and then work into a step two. And I've done that. And I didn't have any reservations about doing that, because it was where I was at, you know. And I think I've learned a lot. You know, I now have different experiences of the disease manifesting, and I also have different tools on what I need to do. But I think what's happened as well is that I've had to learn how to love Leslie, because I'm really good at loving everyone else. But to show that to myself has been really difficult. And it was almost as though my husband left and Leslie appeared. And all the stuff that has always been inside started to come out, and I started to unravel and have lots of memories come up. And it's been an enlightening experience, but it's been a really painful experience, because I've had to be so vigilant around my disease. I've had to, for me, do a lot of work, have a lot of faith in the suggestions that I've been given and the direction, but I never question it. And I think, you know, that being able to remain teachable is such a valuable quality to have, because I know as long as I've got that ability to remain teachable, I will be okay. And it's been dark at times, you know. I can see the time, and I'm going to finish on this. I found out last week my daughter is using crack, and it's just been, this year is the year that's just kept giving. It's just been one bloody thing after the other. And she wouldn't let me see her at first. She got arrested. She's been charged with possession with intent to supply. They've got lots of evidence on her phone to say that she's been doing that. So she's not in a great position. She's moved her crack dealer into her flat. And she didn't tell me straight away. And then when she did, she didn't want to see me. And then she allowed me to go and pick her up yesterday. And I brought her over to mine. I fed her. I bathed her. I took her to an NA meeting. And it was powerful, you know, emotional. She said she listened. But she said she doesn't feel she's bad enough yet. And I get that. And it's brought on a whole new level of powerlessness for me, how I feel about that situation. Because I know, looking at her, what's going to happen. She's the same age as I was when I started using, you know, those types of narcotics. So all I can do is share my experience with her. You know, it goes back to that attraction rather than promotion. Yeah, I want to tie her up. Yeah, I want to kidnap her. Yeah, I want to punch his face in. It's not going to change anything. She'll escape. She'll go back to him. He'll always be there. She's at the beginning of her journey. And all I can do is accept my powerlessness, surrender around that as well, and stay clean a day at a time so that when she reaches out for help, I am here and I can take her to a meeting. I know how to behave around someone else's disease. It's my own that's the problem. So I'm aware that I've shared for a significant amount of time there. I didn't think I'd have anything to say for all that time, but crammed it all in. So it's just such a pleasure to be asked to come and share. And, you know, for me, my gratitude today, I can't even put it into words what I've got. You know, every area of my life has been improved as a direct result of Narcotics Anonymous, and I encounter day-to-day problems, life on life's terms, but I'm getting better at dealing with them, and I'm getting a lot better at dealing with them as a single woman in recovery, you know. So on that note, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you guys for listening.